just by closing my eyes. The bitter cold of that night, the bleakness, the hard, unfriendly lights of a city that was not my city. It was the 14th of February. See, I remember everything. And look at my arms, covered with sweat. They've pulled into goose flesh. Augusta. When I got to Augusta, I was more dead than alive. It was that cold. I had picked a fine day to say goodbye to the college scene and hitchhike west. It looked like I might freeze to death before I got out of the state. A cop had kicked me off the interstate ramp and threatened to bust me if he caught me thumbing there again. I was almost tempted to wise-mouth him and let him do it. The flat four-lane stretch of highway had been like an airport landing strip, the wind whooping and pushing membranes of powdery snow skirling along the concrete. And to the anonymous them behind their safety glass windshields, everyone standing in the breakdown lane on a dark night is either a rapist or a murderer. And if he's got long hair, you can throw in child molester and faggot on top. I tried it a while on the access road, but it was no good. And along about a quarter of eight, I realized that if I didn't get someplace warm quick, I was going to pass out. I walked a mile and a half before I found a combination diner and diesel stop on 202 just inside the city limits. Joe's Good Eats, the neon said. There were three big rigs parked in the crushed stone parking lot and one new sedan. There was a wilted Christmas wreath on the door that nobody had bothered to take down. And next to it, a thermometer showing just 5 degrees of mercury above big zero. I had nothing to cover my ears but my hair, and my rawhide gloves were falling apart. The tips of my fingers felt like pieces of furniture. I opened the door and went in. The heat was the first thing that struck me, warm and good. Next, a hillbilly song on the juke, the unmistakable voice of Merle Haggard. We don't let our hair grow long and shaggy like the hippies out in San Francisco do. The third thing that struck me was the eye. You know about the eye once you let your hair get down below the lobes of your ears. Right then people know you don't belong to the Lions, Elks, or the VFW. You know about the eye, but you never get used to it. Right now, the people giving me the eye were four truckers in one booth, two more at a counter, a pair of old ladies wearing cheap fur coats and blue rinses, the short order cook, and a gawky kid with soap suds on his hands. It was a girl sitting at the far end of the counter, but all she was looking at was the bottom of her coffee cup. She was the fourth thing that struck me. I'm old enough to know there's no such thing as love at first sight. It's just something Rodgers and Hammerstein thought up one day to rhyme with moon and June. It's for kids holding hands at the prom, right? But looking at her made me feel something. You can laugh, but you wouldn't have if you'd seen her. She was almost unbearably beautiful. I knew without a doubt that everybody else in Joe's knew the same thing as me. Just like I knew she had been getting the eye before I came in. She had coal-colored hair so black that it seemed nearly blue under the fluorescence. It fell freely over the shoulders of her scuffed tan coat. Her skin was cream white, with just the faintest blooded touch lingering beneath the skin, the cold she had brought in with her. Dark, sooty lashes, solemn eyes that slanted up the tiniest bit at the corners, a full and mobile mouth below a straight, patrician nose. I couldn't tell what her body looked like. I didn't care. You wouldn't either. All she needed was that face, that hair, that look. She was exquisite. That's the only word we have for her in English. Nona. I sat two stools down from her, and the short order cook came over and looked at me. What? Black coffee, please? He went to get it. From behind me, someone said, Well, I guess Christ came back just like my mama always said he would. The gawky dishwasher laughed, a quick yuck-yuck sound. The truckers at the counter joined in. The short order cook brought me my coffee back, jarred it down on the counter, and spilled some on the thawing meat of my hand. I jerked it back. Sorry, he said indifferently. He's gonna heal it hisself, one of the truckers in the booth called over. The Blue Rinse twins paid their checks and hurried out. One of the knights of the road sauntered over to the Duke and put another dime in. Johnny Cash began to sing A Boy Named Sue. I blew on my coffee. Someone tugged at my sleeve. I turned my head and there she was. She'd moved over to the empty stool. Looking at that face close up was almost blinding. I spilled some more of my coffee. I'm sorry. Her voice was low, almost atonal. My fault, I can't feel what I'm doing yet. She stopped, seemingly at a loss. I suddenly realized that she was scared. I felt my first reaction to her swim over me again, to protect her and take care of her, make her not afraid. I need a ride, she finished in a rush. I didn't dare ask any of them. She made a barely perceptible gesture toward the truckers in the booth. How can I make you understand that I would have given anything, to be able to tell her, sure, finish your coffee, I'm parked right outside. It sounds crazy to say I felt that way after half a dozen words out of her mouth and the same number out of mine, but I did. Looking at her was like looking at the Mona Lisa or the Venus de Milo come to breathing life. And there was another feeling. It was as if a sudden powerful light had been turned on in the confused darkness of my mind. It would make it easier if I could say she was a pickup and I was a fast man with the ladies, quick with a funny line and lots of patter, but she wasn't and I wasn't. All I knew was I didn't have what she needed, and it tore me up. I'm thumbing, I told her. A cop kicked me off the interstate, and I only came here to get out of the cold. I'm sorry. Are you from the university? I was. I quit before they could fire me. Are you going home? No home to go to. I was a state ward. I got to school on a scholarship. I blew it. Now I don't know where I'm going. My life story in 5 sentences. I guess it made me feel depressed. She laughed. The sound made me run hot and cold. We're cats out of the same bag, I guess. I thought she said cats. I thought so. Then. But I've had time to think in here, and more it seems to me that she might have said rats. Rats out of the same bag. Yes. And they are not the same. Are they? I was about to make my best conversational shot, something witty like, is that so? When a hand came down on my shoulder. I turned around. It was one of the truckers from the booth. He had blonde stubble on his chin, and there was a wooden kitchen match poking out of his mouth. He smelled of engine oil and looked like something out of a Steve Ditko drawing. I think you're done with that coffee, he said. His lips parted around the match in a grin. He had a lot of very white teeth. What? You're stinking the place up, fella. You are a fella, aren't you? Kind of hard to tell. You aren't any rose yourself, I said. What's that aftershave, handsome? Ode to crankcase? He gave me a hard shot across the side of the face with his open hand. I saw little black dots. Don't fight in here, the short order cook said. If you're going to scramble him, do it outside. Come on, you goddamn commie, the trucker said. This is the spot where the girl is supposed to say something like, unhand him, or you brute. She wasn't saying anything. She was watching both of us with feverish intensity. It was scary. I think it was the first time I'd noticed how huge her eyes really were. Do I have to sock you again? No. Come on, shitheels. I don't know how that jumped out of me. I don't like to fight. I'm not a good fighter. I'm an even worse name caller. But I was angry just then. It came up on me all at once that I wanted to kill him. Maybe he got a mental whiff of it. For just a second, a shade of uncertainty flicked over his face, an unconscious wondering if maybe he hadn't picked the wrong hippie. Then it was gone. He wasn't going to back off from some long-haired elitist effeminate snob who used the flag to wipe his ass with, at least not in front of his buddies. Not a big old truck-driving son of a gun like him. The anger pounded over me again. Faggot? Faggot? I felt out of control, and it was good to feel that way. My tongue was thick in my mouth. My stomach was a slab. We walked across to the door, and my buddy's buddies almost broke their backs getting up to watch the fun. Nona? I thought of her, but only in an absent, back-of-my-mind way. I knew Nona would be there. Nona would take care of me. I knew it the same way I knew it would be cold outside. It was strange to know that about a girl I had only met 5 minutes before. Strange, but I didn't think about that until later. My mind was taken up, no, almost blotted out, by the heavy cloud of rage. I felt homicidal. The cold was so clear and so clean that it felt as if we were cutting it with our bodies like knives. The frosted gravel of the parking lot gritted harshly under his heavy boots and under my shoes. The moon, full and bloated, looked down on us with a vapid eye. It was faintly ringed, suggesting bad weather on the way. The sky was as black as a night in hell. We left tiny, dwarfed shadows behind our feet in the monochrome glare of a single sodium light set high in a pole beyond the parked rigs. Our breath plumed the air in short bursts. The trucker turned to me, his gloved fists balled. "Okay, you son of a bitch," he said. I seemed to be swelling. My whole body seemed to be swelling. Somehow, numbly, I knew that my intellect was about to be eclipsed by an invisible something that I had never suspected might be in me. It was terrifying, but at the same time I welcomed it, desired it, lusted for it. In that last instant of coherent thought, it seemed that my body had become a stone pyramid, or a cyclone that could sweep everything in front of it like colored pickup sticks. The trucker seemed small, puny, insignificant. I laughed at him. I laughed, and the sound was as black and as bleak as the moonstruck sky overhead. He came at me swinging his fists. I batted down his right, took his left on the side of my face without feeling it, and then kicked him in the guts. The air barfed out of him in a white cloud. He tried to back away, holding himself and coughing. I ran around in back of him, still laughing like some farmer's dog barking at the moon. And I had pounded him 3 times before he could make even a quarter turn, the neck, the shoulder, one red ear. He made a yowling noise, and one of his flailing hands brushed my nose. The fury that had taken me over mushroomed, and I kicked him again, bringing my foot up high and hard like a punter. He screamed into the night, and I heard a rib snap. He folded up, and I jumped him. At the trial, one of the other truck drivers testified I was like a wild animal, and I was. I can't remember much of it, but I can remember that. Snarling and growling at him like a wild dog. I straddled him, grabbed double handfuls of his greasy hair, and began to rub his face into the gravel. In the flat glare of the sodium light, his blood seemed black, like beetle's blood.
"Jesus, stop it!" somebody yelled.
Hands grabbed my shoulders and pulled me off. I saw whirling faces and I struck at them. The trucker was trying to creep away. His face was a staring mask of blood from which his dazed eyes peered. I began to kick him, dodging away from the others, grunting with satisfaction each time I connected on him. He was beyond fighting back. All he knew was to try to get away. Each time I kicked him, his eyes would squeeze closed like the eyes of a tortoise, and he would halt. Then he would start to crawl again. He looked stupid. I decided I was going to kill him. I was going to kick him to death. Then I would kill the rest of them, all but Nona. I kicked him again, and he flopped over on his back and looked up at me dazedly.
"Uncle!"
he croaked.
"I cry, Uncle, please! Please!"
I knelt down beside him, feeling the gravel bite into my knees through my thin jeans. "Here you are, handsome," I whispered. "Here's your uncle." I hooked my hands onto his throat. 3 of them jumped me all at once and knocked me off him. I got up, still grinning, and started toward them. They backed away, 3 big men, all of them scared green. And it clicked off. Just like that, it clicked off, and it was just me. Standing in the parking lot of Joe's Good Eats, breathing hard and feeling sick and horrified. I turned and looked back toward the diner. The girl was there. Her beautiful features were lit with triumph. She raised one fist to shoulder height in salute, like the one those black guys gave at the Olympics that time. I turned back to the man on the ground. He was still trying to crawl away, and when I approached him, his eyeballs rolled fearfully.
"Don't you touch him!"
one of his friends cried. I looked at them confused. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt him so bad. Let me help."
"You get out of here, that's what you do,"
the short order cook said. He was standing in front of Nona at the foot of the steps, clutching a greasy spatula in one hand.
"I'm calling the cops."
"Hey, man, he was the guy who started it.
Don't give me any of your lip, you lousy queer," he said, backing up. "All I know is you just about killed that guy. I'm calling the cops."
He dashed back inside. "Okay," I said to nobody in particular. "Okay, that's good. Okay." I had left my rawhide gloves inside, but it didn't seem like a good idea to go back in and get them. I put my hands in my pockets and started to walk back to the interstate access road. I figured my chances of hitching a ride before the cops picked me up were about 1 in 10. My ears were freezing and I felt sick to my stomach. Some purdy night.
"Wait. Hey, wait."
I turned around. It was her, running to catch up with me, her hair flying out behind her.
"You were wonderful," she said. "Wonderful."
"I hurt him bad," I said dully. "I never did anything like that before.
I wish you'd killed him."
I blinked at her in the frosty light.
"You should have heard the things they were saying about me before you came in. Laughing in that big, brave, dirty way. Ha ha, look at the little girl out so long after dark. Where you going, honey? Need a lift? I'll give you a ride if you'll give me a ride. Damn."
She glared back over her shoulder as if she could strike them dead with a sudden bolt from her dark eyes. Then she turned them on me, and again it seemed like that searchlight had been turned on in my mind.
"My name's Nona. I'm coming with you."
"Where? To jail?" I tugged at my hair with both hands. With this, the first guy who gives us a ride is apt to be a state cop. That cook meant what he said about calling them.
"I'll hitch. You stand behind me. They'll stop for me. They stop for a girl, if she's pretty."
I couldn't argue with her about that, and I didn't want to.
Love at first sight? Maybe not.
But it was something. "Can you get that wave?"
"Here," she said. "You forgot these."
She held out my gloves. She hadn't gone back inside, and that meant she'd had them all along. She'd known she was coming with me. It gave me an eerie feeling. I put on my gloves, and we walked up the access road to the turnpike ramp. She was right about the ride. We got one with the first car that swung onto the ramp. We didn't say anything else while we waited, but it seemed as if we did. I won't give you a load of bull about ESP and that stuff. You know what I'm talking about. You felt it yourself if you've ever been with someone you were really close to, or if you've taken one of those drugs with initials for a name. You don't have to talk. Communication seems to shift over to some high-frequency emotional band. A twist of the hand does it all. We were strangers. I only knew her first name. And now that I think back, I don't believe I ever told her mine at all. But we were doing it. It wasn't love. I hate to keep repeating that, but I feel I have to. I wouldn't dirty that word with whatever we had. Not after what we did. Not after Castle Rock. Not after the dreams. A high wailing shriek filled the cold silence of the night, rising and falling. "That's an ambulance, I think," I said.
"Yes."
Silence again. The moon's light was fading behind a thickening membrane of cloud. I thought the ring around the moon hadn't lied. We would have snow before the night was over. Lights poked over the hill. I stood behind her without having to be told. She brushed her hair back and raised that beautiful face. As I watched the car signal for the entrance ramp, I was swept with a feeling of unreality. It was unreal that this beautiful girl had elected to come with me. It was unreal that I had beaten a man to the point where an ambulance had to be called for him. It was unreal to think I might be in jail by morning. Unreal. I felt caught in a spider web. But who was the spider? Nona put out her thumb. The car, a Chevrolet sedan, went by us and I thought it was going to keep right on going. Then the taillights flashed and Nona grabbed my hand.
"Come on, we got a ride."
She grinned at me with childish delight, and I grinned back at her. The guy was reaching enthusiastically across the seat to open the door for her. When the dome light flashed on, I could see him, a fairly big man, in an expensive camel's hair coat, graying around the edges of his hat, prosperous features softened by years of good meals, a businessman or a salesman, alone. When he saw me, he did a double take, but it was a second or two too late to put the car back in gear and haul ass, and it was easier for him this way. Later he could fib himself into believing he had seen both of us, that he was a truly good-hearted soul giving a young couple a break.
"Cold night," he said, as Nona slid in beside him and I got in beside her.
"Certainly is," Nona said sweetly. "Thank you."
"Yeah," I said, "thanks."
"Don't mention it."
And we were off, leaving sirens, busted-up truckers, and Joe's Good Eats behind us. I had gotten kicked off the interstate at 7:30. It was only 8:30 then. It's amazing how much you can do in a short time, or how much can be done to you.
We were approaching the yellow flashing lights that signal the Augusta toll station.
"How far are you going?" the driver asked.
That was a stumper. I had been hoping to make it as far as Kittery and crash with an acquaintance who was teaching school there. It still seemed as good an answer as any, and I was opening my mouth to give it when Nona said, "We're going to Castle Rock. It's a small town just south and west of Lewiston, Auburn."
Castle Rock. That made me feel strange. Once upon a time, I had been on pretty good terms with Castle Rock, but that was before Ace Merrill messed me up.
The guy brought his car to a stop, took a toll ticket, and then we were on our way again.
"I'm only going as far as Gardner myself," he said, lying smoothly. "One exit up, but that's a start for you."
"It sure is," Nona said, just as sweetly as before. "It was nice of you to stop on such a cold night." And while she was saying it, I was getting her anger on that high emotional wavelength, naked and full of venom. It scared me the way ticking from a wrapped package might scare me.
"My name's Blanchette," he said. "Norman Blanchette."
He waved his hand in our direction to be shaken.
"Cheryl Craig," Nona said, taking it daintily. I took her cue and gave him a false name.
"Pleasure," I mumbled.
His hand was soft and flabby. It felt like a hot water bottle in the shape of a hand. The thought sickened me. It sickened me that we had been forced to beg a ride with this patronizing man who thought he had seen a chance to pick up a pretty girl hitching all by herself. A girl who might or might not agree to an hour spent in a motel room in return for enough cash to buy a bus ticket. It sickened me to know that if I had been alone, this man who had just offered me his flabby, hot hand would have zipped by without a second look. It sickened me to know he would drop us at the Gardner exit, cross over, and then dart right back on the interstate, bypassing us on the southbound ramp without a look, congratulating himself on how smoothly he had solved an annoying situation. Everything about him sickened me. The porky droop of his jowls, the slicked back wigs of his hair, the smell of his cologne. And what right did he have? What right?
The sickness curdled, and the flowers of rage began to bloom again. The headlights of his prosperous Impala sedan cut the night with smooth ease, and my rage wanted to reach out and strangle everything that he was set in among, the kind of music I knew he would listen to as he lay back in his lazy boy recliner with the evening paper in his hot water bottle hands, the rinse his wife would use in her hair, the underalls I knew she would wear, the kids always sent off to the movies or off to school or off to camp as long as they were off somewhere, his snobbish friends and the drunken parties they would attend with them. But his cologne, that was the worst. It filled the car with sweet, sickish scent. It smelled like the perfume disinfectant they use in a slaughterhouse at the end of each shift. The car ripped through the night with Norman Blanchette holding the wheel with his bloated hands. His manicured nails gleamed softly in the lights from the instrument panel. I wanted to crack a wing window and get away from that cloying smell. No, more. I wanted to crank the whole window down and stick my head out into the cold air, wallow in chilled freshness. But I was frozen, frozen in the dumb maw of my wordless, inexpressible hate. That was when Nona put the nail file into my hand. When I was 3, I got a bad case of the flu and had to go to the hospital. While I was there, my dad fell asleep smoking in bed, and the house burned down with my folks and my older brother Drake in it. I have their pictures. They look like actors in an old 1958 American International horror movie. Faces you don't know, like those of the big stars. More like Elisha Cook Jr. and Mara Corday and some child actor you can't quite remember. Brandon DeWilde, maybe? I had no relatives to go to, and so I was sent to a home in Portland for 5 years. Then I became a state ward. That means a family takes you in, and the state pays them $30 a month for your keep. I don't think there was ever a state ward who acquired a taste for lobster. Usually a couple will take 2 or 3 wards, not because the milk of human kindness flows in their veins, but as a business investment. They feed you, they take the 30 the state gives them, and they feed you. If a kid is fed up, he can earn his keep doing chores around the place. That 30 turns into 40, 50, maybe 65 bucks. Capitalism, as it applies to the unhomed. Greatest country in the world, right? My folks were named Hollis, and they lived in Harlow, across the river from Castle Rock. They had a 3-story farmhouse with 14 rooms. There was coal heat in the kitchen that got upstairs any way it could. In January, you went to bed with 3 quilts over you, and still weren't sure if your feet were on when you woke up in the morning. You had to put them on the floor where you could look at them to be sure. Mrs. Hollis was fat. Mr. Hollis was skimpy and rarely spoke. He wore a red and black hunting cap all year round. The house was a helter-skelter mess of white elephant furniture, rummage sale stuff, moldy mattresses, dogs, cats, and automotive parts laid on newspaper. I had 3 brothers, all of them wards. We had a nodding acquaintance, like co-travelers on a 3-day bus trip. I made good grades in school and went out for spring baseball when I was a high school sophomore. Hollis was yapping after me to quit, but I stuck with it until the thing with Ace Merrill happened. Then I didn't want to go anymore, not with my face all puffed out and cut, not with the stories Betsy Malenfant was telling around. So I quit the team, and Hollis got me a job jerking sodas in the local drugstore. In February of my junior year, I took the college boards, paying for them with the 12 bucks I had socked away in my mattress. I got accepted at the university with a small scholarship and a good work-study job in the library. The expression on the Hollis's faces when I showed them the financial aid papers is the best memory of my life. One of my brothers, Kurt, ran away. I couldn't have done that. I was too passive to take a step like that. I would have been back after 2 hours on the road. School was the only way out for me, and I took it. The last thing Mrs. Hollis said when I left was, "You send us something when you can." I never saw either of them again. I made good grades my freshman year and got a job that summer working full-time in the library. I sent them a Christmas card that first year, but that was the only one. In the first semester of my sophomore year, I fell in love. It was the biggest thing that had ever happened to me. Pretty? She would have knocked you back 2 steps. To this day, I have no idea what she saw in me. I don't even know if she loved me or not. I think she did, at first. After that, I was just a habit that's hard to break, like smoking or driving with your elbow poked out the window. She held me for a while, maybe not wanting to break the habit. Maybe she held me for wonder, or maybe it was just her vanity. "Good boy, roll over. Sit up. Fetch the paper. Here's a kiss goodnight." It doesn't matter. For a while, it was love. Then it was like love. Then it was over. I slept with her 2, both times after other things had taken over for love. That fed the habit for a little while. Then she came back from the Thanksgiving break and said she was in love with a Delta Tau Delta who came from her hometown. I tried to get her back and almost made it once, but she had something she hadn't had before. Perspective. Whatever I had been building up all those years since the fire wiped out the B-movie actors who had once been my family, that broke it down. That guy's pin on her blouse.
After that, I was on again, off again with 3 or 4 girls who were willing to sleep with me. I could blame it on my childhood, say I never had good sexual models, but that wasn't it. I'd never had any trouble with the girl, only now that the girl was gone. I started being afraid of girls, a little. And it wasn't so much the ones I was impotent with as the ones I wasn't, the ones I could make it with. They made me uneasy. I kept asking myself where they were hiding whatever axes they liked to grind and when they were going to let me have it. I'm not so strange at that. You show me a married man or a man with a steady woman, and I'll show you someone who is asking himself, maybe only in the early hours of the morning or on Friday afternoon when she's off buying groceries, what is she doing when I'm not around? What does she really think of me? And maybe most of all, how much of me has she got? How much is left? Once I started thinking about those things, I thought about them all the time. I started to drink, and my grades took a nosedive. During semester break, I got a letter saying that if they didn't improve in 6 weeks, my second semester scholarship check would be withheld. I and some guys I hung around with got drunk and stayed drunk for the whole holiday. On the last day, we went to a whorehouse, and I operated just fine. It was too dark to see faces. My grades stayed about the same. I called the girl once and cried over the telephone. She cried too, and in a way I think that pleased her. I didn't hate her then, and I don't now, but she scared me. She scared me plenty. On February 9th, I got a letter from the Dean of Arts and Sciences saying I was flunking 2 or 3 courses in my major field. On February 13th, I got a hesitant sort of letter from the girl. She wanted everything to be all right between us. She was planning to marry the guy from Delta Tau Delta in July or August, and I could be invited if I wanted to be. That was almost funny. What could I give her for a wedding gift? My heart with a red ribbon tied around it? My head? My cock? On the 14th, Valentine's Day, I decided it was time for a change of scene. Nona came next, but you know about that. You have to understand how she was to me if this is going to do any good at all. She was more beautiful than the girl, but that wasn't it. Good looks are cheap in a wealthy country. It was her inside. She was sexy, but the sexiness that came from her was somehow plant-like, blind sex, a kind of clinging, not-to-be-denied sex that is not so important because it is as instinctual as photosynthesis. Not like an animal, but like a plant. You get that wave? I knew we would make love, that we would make it as men and women do, but that our joining would be as blunt and remote and meaningless as ivy clinging its way up a trellis in the August sun. The sex was important only because it was unimportant. I'm sure, that violence was the real motive force. The violence was real and not just a dream. It was as big and as fast and as hard as Ace Merrill's 52 Ford. The violence of Joe's Good Eats, the violence of Norman Blanchett. And there was even something blind and vegetative about that. Maybe she was only a clinging vine after all, because the Venus flytrap is a species of vine. But that plant is carnivorous and will make animal motion when a fly or a bit of raw meat is placed in its jaws. And it was all real. The sporulating vine may only dream that it fornicates, but I am sure the Venus flytrap tastes that fly, relishes its diminishing struggle as its jaws close around it. The last part was my own passivity. I could not fill up the hole in my life. Not the hole left by the girl when she said goodbye. I don't want to lay this at her door. But the hole that had always been there. The dark, confused swirling that never stopped down in the middle of me. Nona filled that hole. She made me move and act. She made me noble. Now maybe you understand a little of it. Why I dream of her. Why the fascination remains in spite of the remorse and the revulsion. Why I hate her, why I fear her, and why even now I still love her.
It was 8 miles from the Augusta ramp to Gardiner, and we did it in a few short minutes. I grasped the nail file woodenly at my side and watched the green reflectorized sign, "Keep right for exit 14," twinkle up out of the night. The moon was gone, and it had begun to spit snow.
"Wish I were going farther," Blanchette said.
"That's all right," Nona said warmly, and I could feel her fury buzzing and burrowing into the meat under my skull like a drill bit. "Just drop us at the top of the ramp." He drove up, observing the ramp speed of 30 miles an hour. I knew what I was going to do. It felt as if my legs had turned to warm lead. The top of the ramp was lit by one overhead light. To the left, I could see the lights of Gardiner against the thickening cloud cover. To the right, nothing but blackness. There was no traffic coming either way along the access road. I got out. Nona slid across the seat, giving Norman Blanchette a final smile. I wasn't worried. She was quarterbacking the play. Blanchette was smiling an infuriating porky smile, relieved at being rid of us.
"Well, good night.
Oh, my purse! Don't drive off with my purse!"
"I'll get it," I told her. I leaned back into the car. Blanchette saw what I had in my hand, and the porky smile on his face froze solid. Now lights showed on the hill, but it was too late to stop. Nothing could have stopped me. I picked up Nona's purse with my left hand. With my right, I plunged the steel nail file into Blanchette's throat. He bleated once. I got out of the car. Nona was waving the oncoming vehicle down. I couldn't see what it was in the darkened snow. All I could make out were the two bright circles of its headlamps. I crouched behind Blanchette's car, peeking through the back windows. The voices were almost lost in the filling throat of the wind.
"Trouble, lady?
Father, Wind, had a heart attack, will you?" I scurried around the trunk of Norman Blanchette's Impala, bent over. I could see them now. Nona's slender silhouette and a taller form. They appeared to be standing by a pickup truck. They turned and approached the driver's side window of the Chevy, where Norman Blanchette was slumped over the wheel with Nona's file in his throat. The driver of the pickup was a young kid in what looked like an Air Force parka. He leaned inside. I came up behind him.
"Jesus, lady," he said. "There's blood on this guy. What?"
I hooked my right elbow around his throat and grabbed my right wrist with my left hand. I pulled him up hard. His head connected with the top of the door and made a hollow thunk. He went limp in my arms. I could have stopped then. He hadn't gotten a good look at Nona, hadn't seen me at all. I could have stopped. But he was a busybody, a meddler. Somebody else in our way, trying to hurt us. I was tired of being hurt. I strangled him. When it was done, I looked up and saw Nona spotlighted in the conflicting lights of the car and the truck. Her face, a grotesque rictus of hate, love, triumph, and joy. She held her arms out to me, and I went into them. We kissed. Her mouth was cold, but her tongue was warm. I plunged both hands into the secret hollows of her hair, and the wind screamed around us.
"Now fix it," she said, "before someone else comes."
I fixed it. It was a slipshod job, but I knew that was all we needed. A little more time, and after that it wouldn't matter. We would be safe. The kid's body was light. I picked him up in both arms, carried him across the road, and threw him into the gully beyond the guardrails. His body tumbled loosely all the way down to the bottom, head over heels like the rag bag man Mr. Hollis had put out in the cornfield every July. I went back to get Blanchette. He was heavier and bleeding like a stuck pig. I tried to pick him up, staggered 3 steps backward, and then he slipped out of my arms and fell onto the road. I turned him over. The new snow had stuck to his face, turning it into a skier's mask. I bent over, grabbed him under the arms, and dragged him to the gully. His feet left trailing grooves behind him. I threw him over and watched him slide down the embankment on his back, his arms up over his head. His eyes were wide open, staring raptly at the snowflakes falling into them. If the snow kept coming, They would both be just two vague humps by the time the plows came by. I went back across the road. Nona had already climbed into the pickup truck without having to be told which vehicle we would use. I could see the pallid smear of her face, the dark holes of her eyes, but that was all. I got into Blanchett's car, sitting in the streaks of his blood that had gathered on the nubby vinyl seat cover, and drove it onto the shoulder. I turned off the headlights, put on the four-way flashers, and got out. To anyone passing by, it would look like a motorist who had engine trouble and then walked into town to find a garage. I was very pleased with my improvisation. It was as if I had been murdering people all my life. I trotted back to the idling truck, got in behind the wheel, and pointed it toward the turnpike entrance ramp. She sat next to me, not touching, but close. When she moved, I could sometimes feel a strand of her hair on my neck. It was like being touched with a tiny electrode. Once I had to put my hand out and feel her leg to make sure she was real. She laughed quietly. It was all real. The wind howled around the windows, driving snow in great flapping gusts. We ran south. Just across the bridge from Harlow, as you go up 126 toward Castle Heights, you come up on a huge renovated farm that goes under the laughable title of the Castle Rock Youth League. They have 12 lanes of candlepin bowling with cranky automatic pin setters that usually take the last 3 days of the week off, a few ancient pinball machines, a juke featuring the greatest hits of 1957, 3 Brunswick pool tables, and a Coke and chips counter, where you also rent bowling shoes that look like they might have just come off the feet of dead winos. The name of the place is laughable because most of the Castle Rock youth head up to the drive-in at Jay Hill at night or go to the stock car races at Oxford Plains. The people who do hang out there are mostly toughies from Gretna, Harlow, and the Rock itself. The average is one fight per evening in the parking lot. I started hanging out there when I was a high school sophomore. One of my acquaintances, Bill Kennedy, was working there 3 nights a week, and if there was nobody waiting for a table, he'd let me shoot some pool for free. It wasn't much, but it was better than going back to the Hollis's house. That's where I met Ace Merrill. Nobody much doubted that he was the toughest guy in three towns. He drove a chopped and channeled 52 Ford, and it was rumored that he could push it all the way to 130 if he had to. He'd come in like a king, his hair greased back and glistening in a perfect duck's-ass pompadour. Shoot a few games of double bank for a dime a ball. Was he good? You guess. Buy Betsy a Coke when she came in, and then they'd leave. You could almost hear a reluctant sigh of relief from those present when the scarred front door wheezed shut. Nobody ever went out in the parking lot with Ace Merrill. Nobody, that is, but me. Betsy Mlanfont was his girl. The prettiest girl in Castle Rock, I guess. I don't think she was terrifically bright, but that didn't matter when you got a look at her. She had the most flawless complexion I had ever seen, and it didn't come out of a cosmetic bottle either. Hair as black as coal, dark eyes, generous mouth, a body that just wouldn't quit. And she didn't mind showing it off. Who was going to drag her out back and try to stoke her locomotive while Ace was around? Nobody sane, that's who. I fell hard for her. Not like the girl, and not like Nona, even though Betsy did look like a younger version of her. But it was just as desperate and just as serious in its way. If you've ever had the worst case of puppy love going around, you know how I felt. She was 17, 2 years older than I. I started going down there more and more often, even nights when Billy wasn't on, just to catch a glimpse of her. I felt like a bird watcher, except it was a desperate kind of game for me. I'd go back home, lie to the Hollises about where I'd been, and climb up to my room. I'd write long, passionate letters to her, telling her everything I'd like to do to her, and then tear them up. Study halls at school, I'd dream about asking her to marry me so we could run away to Mexico together. She must have tumbled to what was happening, and it must have flattered her a little because she was nice to me when Ace wasn't around. She'd come over and talk to me, let me buy her a Coke, sit on a stool, and kind of rub her leg against mine.
It drove me crazy. One night in early November, I was just mooning around, shooting a little pool with Bill, waiting for her to come in. The place was deserted because it wasn't even 8 o'clock yet, and a lonesome wind was snuffling around outside, threatening winter. "You better lay off," Bill said, shooting the 9 straight into the corner. "Lay off what?" "You know." "No, I don't." I scratched, and Billy added a ball to the table. He ran 6, and while he was running them, I went over and put a dime in the juke. "Betsy Mlanfant." He lined up the 1 carefully and sent it walking up the rail. "Charlie Hogan was telling Ace about the way you've been sniffing around her. Charlie thought it was really funny, her being older and all, but Ace wasn't laughing." "She's nothing to me," I said through paper lips. "She better not be," Bill said. And then a couple of guys came in and he went over to the counter and gave them a cue ball. Ace came in around 9, and he was alone. He'd never taken any notice of me before, and I'd just about forgotten what Billy said. When you're invisible, you get to thinking you're invulnerable. I was playing pinball, and I was pretty involved. I didn't even notice the place get quiet as people stopped bowling or shooting pool. The next thing I knew, somebody had thrown me right across the pinball machine. I landed on the floor in a heap. I got up, feeling scared and sick. He had tilted the machine, wiping out my 3 replays. He was standing there looking at me, with not a strand of hair out of place, his Garrison jacket half unzipped. "You stop messing around," he said softly, "or I'm gonna change your face." He went out. Everybody was looking at me, and I wanted to sink right down through the floor until I saw there was a kind of grudging admiration on most of their faces. So I brushed myself off, unconcerned, and put another dime in the pinball machine. The tilt light went out. A couple of guys came over and clapped me on the back before they went out, not saying anything. At 11, when the place closed, Billy offered me a ride home. "You're gonna take a fall if you don't watch out." "Don't worry about me," I said. He didn't answer. 2 or 3 nights later, Betsy came in by herself around 7. There was one other kid there, this weird little 4 eyes named Vern Tessio, who flunked out of school a couple years before. I hardly noticed him. He was even more invisible than I was. She came right over to where I was shooting, close enough so I could smell the clean soap smell on her skin. It made me feel dizzy. "Heard about what Ace did to you," she said. "I'm not supposed to talk to you anymore, and I'm not going to. But I've got something to make it all better." She kissed me. Then she went out before I could even get my tongue down from the roof of my mouth. I went back to my game in a daze. I didn't even see Tessio when he went out to spread the word. I couldn't see anything but her dark, dark eyes. So later that night, I ended up in the parking lot with Ace Merrill, and he beat the living Jesus out of me. It was cold, bitterly cold, and at the end I began to sob, not caring who was watching or listening, which by then was everybody. The single sodium arc lamp looked down on all of it mercilessly. I didn't even land a punch on him. "Okay," he said, squatting down next to me. He wasn't even breathing hard. He took a switchblade out of his pocket and pressed the chrome button. 7 inches of moon-drenched silver sprang into the world. "This is what you get next time. I'll carve my name on your balls." Then he got up, gave me 1 last kick, and left. I just lay there for maybe 10 minutes, shivering on the hard-packed dirt. No one came to help me up or pat me on the back, not even Bill. Betsy didn't show up to make it all better. Finally, I got up by myself and hitchhiked home. I told Mrs. Hollis I'd hitched a ride with a drunk and he drove off the road. I never went back to the bowling alley again. I understand that Ace dropped Betsy not long after, and from then on she went downhill at a rapidly increasing rate of speed, like a pulp truck with no brakes. She picked up a case of clap on the way. Billy said he saw her one night in the Manoir up in Lewiston, hustling guys for drinks. She had lost most of her teeth, and her nose had been broken somewhere along the line, he said. He said I would never recognize her. By then, I didn't much care one way or the other. The pickup had no snow tires, and before we got to the Lewiston exit, I had begun to skid around in the new powder. It took us over 45 minutes to make the 22 miles. The man at the Lewiston exit point took my toll card and my 60 cents.
Slippery traveling?
Neither of us answered him. We were getting close to where we wanted to go now. If I hadn't had that odd kind of wordless contact with her, I would have been able to tell just by the way she sat on the dusty seat of the pickup, her hands folded tightly over her purse, those eyes fixed straight ahead on the road with fierce intensity. I felt a shudder work through me. We took Route 136. There weren't many cars on the road. The wind was freshening, and the snow was coming down harder than ever. On the other side of Harlow Village, we passed a big Buick Riviera that had slewed around sideways and climbed the curb. Its four-way flashers were going, and I had a ghostly double image of Norman Blanchett's Impala. It would be drifted in with snow now, nothing but a ghostly lump in the darkness. The Buick's driver tried to flag me down, but I went by him without slowing, spraying him with slush. My wipers were clogging with snow, and I reached out and snapped at the one on my side. Some of the snow loosened, and I could see a little better. Harlow was a ghost town, everything dark and closed. I signaled right to go over the bridge into Castle Rock. The rear wheels wanted to slide out from under me, but I handled the skid. Up ahead and across the river, I could see the dark shadow that was the Castle Rock Youth League building. It looked shut up and lonely. I felt suddenly sorry. Sorry that there had been so much pain and death. That was when Nona spoke for the first time since the Gardner exit. There's a policeman behind you. Is he? No, his flash was off. But it made me nervous, and maybe that's why it happened. Route 136 makes a 90-degree turn on the Harlow side of the river, and then it's straight across the bridge into Castle Rock. I made the first turn, but there was ice on the rock side. Damn! The rear end of the truck flirted around, and before I could steer clear, it had smashed into one of the heavy steel bridge stanchions. We went sliding all the way around like kids on a flexible flyer, and the next thing I saw was the bright headlights of the police car behind us. He put on his brakes. I could see the red reflections in the falling snow. But the ice got him, too. He plowed right into us. There was a grinding, jarring shock as we went into the supporting girders again. I was jolted into Nona's lap, and even in that confused split second, I had time to relish the smooth firmness of her thigh. Then everything stopped. Now the cop had his flasher on. It sent blue revolving shadows chasing across the hood of the truck and the snowy steel crosswork of the Harlow Castle Rock Bridge. The dome light inside the cruiser came on as the cop got out. If he hadn't been behind us, it wouldn't have happened. That thought was playing over and over in my mind like a phonograph needle stuck in a single flawed groove. I was grinning a strained, frozen grin into the dark as I groped on the floor of the truck's cab for something to hit him with. There was an open toolbox. I came up with a socket wrench and laid it on the seat between Nona and me. The cop leaned in the window, his face changing like a devil's in the light from his flasher.
"Traveling a little fast for the conditions, weren't you, guy?"
"Following a little close, weren't you?" I asked. "For the conditions?" He might have flushed. It was hard to tell in the flickering light.
"Are you lipping off to me, son?"
"I am if you're trying to pin the dents in your cruiser on me."
"Let's see your driver's license and your registration."
I got out my wallet and handed him my license.
"Registration?"
"It's my brother's truck. He carries the registration in his wallet."
"That right?"
He looked at me hard, trying to stare me down. When he saw it would take a while, he looked past me at Nona. I could have ripped his eyes out for what I saw in them.
"What's your name?"
"Cheryl Craig, sir."
"What are you doing riding around in his brother's pickup in the middle of a snowstorm, Cheryl?"
"We're going to see my uncle."
In Iraq?
That's right, yes.
I don't know any Craigs in Castle Rock.
His name is Emmons, on Bowen Hill?
That right. He walked around to the back of the truck to look at the plate. I opened the door and leaned out. He was writing it down. He came back while I was still leaning out, spotlighted from the waist up in the glare of his headlights.
I'm going to, what's that all over you, boy?
I didn't have to look down to know what was all over me. I used to think that leaning out like that was just absent-mindedness. But writing all of this has changed my mind. I don't think it was absent-minded at all. I think I wanted him to see it. I held on to the socket wrench.
What do you mean?
He came two steps closer.
You're hurt. Cut yourself, looks like.
Better... I swung at him. His hat had been knocked off in the crash and his head was bare. I hit him dead on, just above the forehead. I've never forgotten the sound that made, like a pound of butter falling onto a hard floor.
Hurry, Nona said.
She put a calm hand on my neck. It was very cool, like air in a root cellar. My foster mother had a root cellar. Funny I should remember that. She sent me down there for vegetables in the winter. She canned them herself. Not in real cans, of course, but in thick mason jars, with those rubber sealers that go under the lid. I went down there one day to get a jar of waxed beans for our supper. The preserves were all in boxes, neatly marked in Mrs. Hollis's hand. I remember that she always misspelled raspberry, and that used to fill me with a secret superiority. On this day, I went past the boxes marked R-A-Z-B-E-R-R-Y, and into the corner where she kept the beans. It was cool and dark. The walls were plain dark earth, and in wet weather, they exuded moisture in trickling, crooked streams. The smell was a secret, dark effluvium composed of living things and earth and stored vegetables, a smell remarkably like that of a woman's private parts. There was an old, shattered printing press in one corner that had been there ever since I came, and sometimes I used to play with it and pretend I could get it going again. I loved the root cellar. In those days, I was 9 or 10, the root cellar was my favorite place. Mrs. Hollis refused to set foot in it, and it was against her husband's dignity to go down and fetch up vegetables. So I went there and smelled that peculiar, secret, earthy smell, and enjoyed the privacy of its womb-like confinement. It was lit by one cobwebby bulb that Mr. Hollis had strung, probably before the Boer War. Sometimes I wiggled my hands and made huge, elongated rabbits on the wall. I got the beans and was about to go back when I heard a rustling movement under one of the old boxes. I went over and lifted it up. There was a brown rat beneath it, lying on its side. It rolled its head up at me and stared. Its sides were heaving violently and it bared its teeth. It was the biggest rat I had ever seen, and I leaned closer. It was in the act of giving birth. Two of its young, hairless and blind, were already nursing at its belly. Another was halfway into the world. The mother glared at me helplessly, ready to bite. I wanted to kill it, kill all of them, squash them, but I couldn't. It was the most horrible thing I'd ever seen. As I watched, a small brown spider, a daddy longlegs, I think, crawled rapidly across the floor. The mother snatched it up and ate it. I fled. Halfway up the stairs, I fell and broke the jar of beans. Mrs. Hollis thrashed me, and I never went into the root cellar again unless I had to. I stood looking down at the cop, remembering. Hurry, Nona said again. He was much lighter than Norman Blanchett had been. Or perhaps my adrenaline was just flowing more freely. I gathered him up in both arms and carried him over to the edge of the bridge. I could barely make out the falls downstream, and upstream, the GS and WM railroad trestle was only a gaunt shadow, like a scaffold. The night wind whooped and screamed, and the snow beat against my face. For a moment I held the cop against my chest like a sleeping newborn child, and then I remembered what he really was, and threw him over the side and down into the darkness.
We went back to the truck and got in, but it wouldn't start. I cranked the engine until I could smell the sweetish aroma of gas from the flooded carb and then stopped. Come on, I said. We went to the cruiser. The front seat was littered with violation tags, forms,